schlesische Tor. Aufstieg rechts.
Der deutsche Spargelkult müsse enden.
Germany's beleaguered defense minister has temporarily dropped his PhD title.
Volkswagen ist eine Perle der deutschen Industrie. Und ich glaube, das kann man nicht
sagen. Ich weiß, wie viel Liebe dahinter steckt. Wenn Glühweinstände aufgebaut werden, wenn Waffen...
Spargel-Weltmeister ist China, denn die bauen 60 Mal mehr...
Hey, this is Ted. Welcome to Spaßbremse. It's actually just me today from the typical Spaßbremse crew, and usually when you hear that, you're probably thinking, all right, this is going to be Ted talking for an hour about tanks or the German economy or something like that. But we've actually got a guest and a topic that, at least on the surface, is about as far away from that as possible, but as we'll hear, might actually relate to politics more than meets the eye initially. We are talking about Eurovision. The song extravaganza, which that I know very little about, but luckily we've got an excellent guest. It's Kat Friga, a modern European historian at the University of Oxford. Kat, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So this episode actually stems from an after lunch chat that Kat and I were having at Oxford, and somehow Eurovision came up, and she was a fountain of knowledge and all these opinions about Eurovision. I was like, wait, we got to have you on. We got to have you on to talk about this because I found it very interesting, all the things you were saying. And I, as I said, know very little about this, I guess as like a demographic that is probably inclined to be uninterested in Eurovision. A straight North American male is like maybe not typically the main audience for this. So this will be a good way for me to learn a bit more about it. And I'm very excited. So, and the final, of course, is on May 13th, Saturday, which should be when this episode is released. So this is a good way to get a bit of background in it. We won't speculate too much about the winners and so on. I hear that Sweden is favored, but I haven't seen any of it. So maybe I'll tune in tomorrow. Yeah. So like what is Eurovision? Because when I got to Europe, everyone's talking about this. It's this big thing. And I had honestly never heard about it when I lived in the US.
Yeah, maybe it's the best kept European secret, because if you're in Europe, you know about Eurovision, and if you're not, or in Australia, you know about it, but if you're not, then it's kind of just this chaotic thing that doesn't make sense. Essentially, your countries who belong to the European Broadcasting Union can choose to send a contestant to represent their nation on the Eurovision stage, and every year for a week in May, there's a song contest. It's as if nations were doing America's Got Talent.
So it's like, but it's like a set band or artist that comes from the nation. So it's sort of like a set team that represents it. And there's like.
Yeah. Nations choose which musicians they would like to represent them. There's a couple of rules. Every year, every act must be an original song. It has to be less than 3 minutes long. And so it's not like you can send Harry Styles to perform his most famous hit. That doesn't work. And usually what countries will do in the run-up to Eurovision is that they'll host local competitions to see who would like to perform on the sort of bigger European Eurovision stage. And as long as it kind of conforms to this, that it's less than 3 minutes, and that it represents the country and that it's an original song, then it can make the cut.
And yeah, it seems like often they're pretty kind of niche things and not necessarily artists that blow up, but there's a few like ABBA came out of Eurovision, right? Like some that actually really become worldwide famous from this. So it's not yeah, totally just confined to Europe forever, but I never knew that ABBA came from Eurovision until I started learning a little bit more about Eurovision. I don't think the average person in North America would necessarily know that.
ABBA is the most famous Eurovision export, I think, because they like their fame is so rooted in Eurovision. They won in 1973 with Waterloo. Other famous names who have sort of performed at Eurovision include Celine Dion, I think, for Switzerland. So she's also super famous, of course. Julio Iglesias performed at Eurovision. So there's a couple of famous names out there, but in general, your Eurovision stars won't be as well known outside of the Eurovision orbit.
Sort of like its own little mini league for like non-anglophone chart topping things, it seems. And you know, there's a lot of like fancy costumes and really silly, kind of over the top entertainment. It's very, it's quite a spectacle. I did see it last year for the first time. But the thing that's often pointed out when people talk about Eurovision, they say, you know, Eurovision isn't just about pop music and camp. You know, it's actually a lot about politics. And, you know, you kind of hear this phrase over and over, which obviously I don't doubt. And is basically the reason we wanted to do an episode about this. But people sometimes say this without actually getting into, you know, well, what specifically does it represent if it represents more than just this sort of silly musical extravaganza? And so I want to get into that because, like I said, Kat is very informed about this and has some very interesting thoughts. So it seems like there's kind of two main themes that often come out, which is the role of national identity and Europeanness and where those borders are drawn and how states kind of assert themselves within the Eurovision context of their national identity. And then also it's closely tied with queer and trans representation. It has been an important part of the Eurovision contest for several decades here. So I'd like to get into both of those topics, but probably the best way to get into all of this Eurovision, the meaning of Eurovision, is to start with a bit of history. Like you said, it's actually like a kind of a quintessentially European thing in a way, where it creates this whole kind of cultural extravaganza, but it's based on a kind of a boring bureaucratic political construct of the European Broadcasting Union. And so it kind of parallels the EU in a way that you start with this kind of technocratic organization and then you build this whole construct on top of it. So could you talk a little bit about, yeah, the structure and the founding and then maybe some of the key moments and its evolution over the decades?
Yeah, absolutely. Eurovision has existed since 1956. And there has been a Eurovision Song Contest every year since then, except for 2020, when it was canceled due to the COVID-19 pandemic. It is indeed born out of the European Broadcasting Union. And I think oftentimes when we think about Eurovision, we think that it is a celebration of sort of international exchange and national identity within the European continent. But in fact, it was born as a technological experiment. In the 50s, there was now a new possibility to live broadcast across national borders. And so Eurovision Song Contest is kind of an experiment in broadcasting a big show to a very large audience in several different countries. The structure of the contest itself is based on an older Italian music festival called Sanremo, which also still exists, and which has been running yearly since 1951. The first contests in the late 50s and 60s were relatively small, but Eurovision kept growing until the early 90s. It was very Western European dominated. There's a couple of interesting sort of outliers in terms of countries that came to compete. So as I said, until the 1990s, in general, the countries who are being represented at Eurovision are Western European. In 1980, Morocco performed at Eurovision as a kind of example of a non-European country to grace the Eurovision stage. Only the one time, they've never come back. And then once the 90s, after the end of the Cold War, going into the 90s, you have Eastern European countries joining the competition more and more. And this is sort of also where some of the importance of Eurovision as a stage through which to prove European identity, I think, is especially sort of pronounced. Today, the competition is much bigger than it used to be, and it spans a week instead of just an evening. There's two semifinals, and then the big event is the finals, which will be on Saturday.
And so it's a really, like, again, it's, I didn't know anything about it before moving, and it seemed so strange, but it's really like hundreds of millions of people tune into this. Like, it's one of the biggest televised events in the world, or at least within Europe, right?
It's the largest televised event that isn't sports. So the largest non-sporting television event, and one of the longest running television events in existence.
And I should say that producer Isaac, has written a great piece on Eurovision last year, and he wasn't able to join, but I want to share his voice a little bit on this episode. So I'll read a couple passages from his piece that I think also speaks to this kind of founding moment and the logic behind it. And he says, something that's very in line with what you say, quoting from the piece, the origin myth of Eurovision is that it began as a way of promoting cooperation and European unity following the Second World War, according to Catherine Baker, historian at the University of Hull. The truth is a bit thornier, however, and this unity myth has obscured some of the geopolitical divides that became entrenched in the contest later on. The actual reasons for starting the contest were about technological cooperation between international broadcasters and showing that it was possible to do something that Baker says hadn't been done before, host a televised contest in one country and relay it live to other participating countries, which, yeah, is very very in line with what you're saying, and kind of seems crazy from a modern perspective, right? That this whole cultural phenomenon comes from what now seems like a pretty banal technological achievement, but is really them kind of showing off what they're capable of. And you also highlight in what you've written on this that the role of technology and innovation throughout time is kind of a core part of the identity and the purpose of the song contest.
Yeah, absolutely. I think technology still plays a really big role in Eurovision, maybe no longer at its very core, because we are now so used to live and international television broadcasts. But I think that Eurovision sort of, quote unquote, went online in 2001, which is relatively early for such a big thing. And even today, sort of what is really common at a Eurovision final song contest is every country is introduced with what is called a postcard. And it's essentially a very short video that advertises the country. It's, you know, the idea is then that maybe tourists will be able to visit or that they'll have a sense of which country this is. And something that this is anecdotal, but something that I've recently noticed in the last few years is that they're really hyping the drone technology. And, you know, it's a very small thing, but I do think that technology and innovation is still a key part of Eurovision and is kind of embedded in the contest structures. This is also true for sort of like lighting on stage, or sort of Eurovision really loves to go the extra mile in its performance and its sets and its stage lighting. And this too requires, you know, a huge amount of energy and technological expertise in order to pull off a show like this.
And it seems like given the timing, I mean, this is just me speculating and reading into it a bit, but there's this sort of like a transatlantic shadow hanging over the whole thing with Europe having been destroyed by the war, America being ahead technologically, obviously, you know, Hollywood and the sort of assumed that America is leading in these kind of creating these entertainment spectacles. And it seems like a way of for Europe to kind of unite and try to combine and then demonstrate its technological sophistication that it too can create these entertainment spectacles using the latest technology and not to completely cede that cultural front to America. When you see, you know, complaints about American cultural imperialism in say France and the film industry, it seems like this is kind of adjacent to some of those anxieties and fears and European pride.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that makes a lot of sense. And then at the same time, that's the sort of like transatlantic shadow. And for a lot of Eurovision's history, at least in the beginning, there was also the shadow of the Cold War, which also plays a role in this kind of what kind of spectacle is Western Europe able to put on stage.
And this great segue, because what I want to talk about as well is something that, you know, if Eurovision is not terribly well known outside of Europe's borders, even less so is this thing I found really fascinating, Intervision, which is effectively, if Eurovision during the Cold War was NATO, this is like the Warsaw Pact of Eurovision. Like they had their own Eastern Bloc equivalent, I guess, to, again, you know, the sort of constantly competing and trying to show your own cultural relevance of like, oh, the Western Europeans get this fun, campy contest. Well, we should have something too for the Eastern Bloc. And so they have their own equivalent for a while. It ended before the actual fall of the Eastern Bloc, though. It ended in 1980, I believe. What was Intervision? Where did this come from? And what were some of the kind of key moments and differences between West and East in the song contest?
Intervision Song Contest was a direct response to Eurovision Song Contest. And it's really interesting because on the one hand, it was an effort on part of the Eastern Bloc during the Cold War to show independence in terms of having entertainment and sort of mass entertainment, popular culture, and a spectacle on a stage. But on the other hand, because it's a direct response to Eurovision Song Contest, it also kind of hints at a certain level of dependence or sort of, if you are responding to something that already exists, by default, you're defining itself in relation to that. And so even though Intervision is sort of this idea of it being sort of an independent Eastern Bloc version of Eurovision, it's always going to stand in relation to Eurovision in this sense. Yeah, there were fewer events. I think 1977 to 1980 is the sort of Intervision period that is most well known. I think there were also a few song contests in the 60s. But yeah, it's this really interesting space that is kind of between a defiant socialist version of Eurovision, but that it also very much takes its cues from Western mass entertainment. And so it even invites a lot of Western artists. The Intervision Song Contest organizers even invited a lot of Western artists to come and perform. One of my favorite stories, which I was telling Ted about earlier, is that they had Boney M. come to perform on the Intervision stage, and beforehand had sort of really emphasized that the song, the famous song Rasputin, can definitely not be part of the set list. But of course, Boney M. were like, well, we're going to do it anyway. And then the song was, it was sort of distributed live on the radio as a radio broadcast and as a televised broadcast, but only the radio was live. And so if you were listening to the Intervision Song Contest in the Eastern Bloc, then you could hear Boney M's song Rasputin, but in the official sort of like televised version, the authorities had cut it out, which is kind of a neat little hiccup in the smooth running of this song contest.
That's really interesting. And yeah, I mean, as you say, if you're creating a sort of a copy or a response, it's both, as you put it nicely, asserting independence, but also kind of cultural dependence. And it seems really symptomatic of these broader stance of culture broadly defined in the Eastern Bloc, is that they struggle to assert their own version of like cultural modernity, you know, constantly trying to, if you look at, you know, Eastern Germany, we've talked about this before on the podcast, this everyone constantly waiting on this huge wait list to get a car, because like the car culture of the West became the defining thing to emulate, and they're constantly trying to catch up and produce more and more cars or these other knockoff, you know, colas and stuff. And there's not a, it's like the East was constantly chasing the West and trying to make their own sort of knockoff versions of Western products, which then people find very unsatisfying because they want the real deal. And by failing to create an independent culture and independent institutions and always emulating the West, you then, it seems like, inevitably sow the seeds for the demise of that. And the, you know, the Intervision is just yet another example of East emulating West rather than asserting its own unique version of culture.
Yeah, I mean, likely they would have said that Intervision was the unique culture in and of itself, but the parallels are just too strong, I would say. And then I also think that, you know, this history can still be felt today. And this is also going to sort of open up the political implications of Eurovision and how Eurovision, despite officially and explicitly defining itself as apolitical, is anything but. In 2014, the winner of Eurovision was Austria with Conchita Wurst and the song Rise Like a Phoenix. And so she's a drag queen, a bearded drag queen. And it was a sort of very prominent win, which kind of made headlines everywhere. And she's very popular. However, in response to this, Vladimir Putin suggested restarting Intervision Song Contest because Conchita Wurst's win was evidence of the sort of moral decay of Europe. So this was in the year 2014, which is, of course, also the same year that Russia invaded and annexed Crimea. And so sort of thinking about these two separate events in conversation with one another, and then Putin's sort of idea of reopening Intervision with with Russia as its kind of like leader, but also Central Asian countries also competing, I think kind of opens the door into how these kinds of stages are definitely also political.
I love all these examples of these like big, tough, kind of strong men leaders getting really, really upset about like just like campy cultural things. You know, like when Donald Trump is like, oh, it's terrible what's happening to, you know, some play on Broadway. And he's really mad about like how they're changing the songs in some Broadway musical, or like the idea of like Vladimir Putin, the like strong, you know, Russian leader is like the song contest is decaying. And it's like, is that... it's such a contrast with their, like how they present themselves, you know, or other conservatives in America getting mad about like the M&Ms. You're like, I thought you were the big manly man, and like you're getting upset about children's toys and candy and songs and all this stuff. It's an endless source of humor. So I did not know that Putin himself was guilty of this, but that's great. And so I think this transitions well to one of the main points I want to raise, that is often discussed, but like I said, in some of your writing on this, I thought you had great perspective on it. And it's this role of national identity and you know, who is and who isn't European, which takes several different forms, I believe, in the contest. One is the actual boundaries of who's in it and who is not. And the other is how countries present themselves in the contest itself once they're in, and kind of how seriously they take it. And it's like, it seems, generally speaking, it's a bit of a generalization, but within the contest, it's like the more established culture, like the bigger cultural powers in the West can have a bit more ironic distance from the contest. Whereas in the East, the countries that are a bit more, their relationship with Europeanness might be a little more tenuous or recent. They kind of really assert this as a stage to say, hey, we, you know, we are a European country, and they take it very seriously. And I know you have some examples of each. So who is European in the context of the European Song Contest, the Eurovision Song Contest? And why are there these weird outliers? Like, what's going on with Australia? What's the deal there? Yeah. How has this border been drawn and shifted over time?
Yeah. So I think, what makes Eurovision interesting is that it defines Europe outside of the usual categories of geography and politics. So geographical location isn't a sort of defining factor, nor is political, you know, direct political belonging. This is because, as I mentioned, the European Broadcasting Union is organizing Eurovision Song Contest. And so to be a member of this broadcasting union is enough in order to sort of be allowed to also try and participate in Eurovision Song Contest. In the 50s, this did have geographic boundaries because technology was still more limited than it is today. But today, Australia can join the European Broadcasting Union, and that's not a technological issue anymore. And so then we can see that because Australia is part of the European Broadcasting Union, they can participate in Eurovision, and the geographic boundary of this kind of like continent of Europe isn't applicable in the same way. And then because Eurovision defines itself as a non-political event, the kind of usual political definitions of Europe don't directly apply either. But this doesn't mean, of course, that what we associate with Europe isn't still relevant. So, for example, Morocco participating in 1980, they did it just 1 year. They're the only sort of North African or Arab country to have participated in Europe. Israel participates frequently. And so who is sort of even interested in having a quote-unquote European stage to perform on is a really interesting question in and of itself. Australia has a really large sort of fandom community, more so than the United States does. And so if I remember correctly, they first joined Eurovision for like the 50 or 60 year anniversary. And then they just kind of loved it so much they kept coming. But a lot of sort of European immigrant communities or diaspora communities in Australia still follow Eurovision. And there's a much bigger culture of watching Eurovision in Australia than there is in the United States. And so there's more interest there. And since the sort of like the rules and regulations and structures allow for it, Australia has for a few years now been a recurring and much loved participant in Eurovision Song Contest. When it comes to sort of what happens once you do decide to step onto this sort of European Eurovision stage, I think is really, really fascinating as well. So if your belonging isn't defined by geography and if it isn't defined by politics, what is it defined by instead? So I would say a kind of cultural idea of European belonging. And for countries that are sort of in the quote-unquote center, this is self-evident and therefore doesn't need to be established. So Germany or France or the Netherlands, who have all been part of Eurovision from sort of from 1956 onwards, they don't need to prove that they're European because everyone already knows this anyway. But for those countries that are kind of like more on a periphery of European cultural belonging, this is an opportunity, or of European belonging, this is an opportunity to demonstrate that they are culturally European in an extravagant and flamboyant and entertaining, but also serious way. And I think that that kind of difference is really notable in how different European nations think about what it means to participate in Eurovision.
Yeah, it seems like too with the Australian case, you could see it being very important for them, being a country of a lot of people descending from Europe in a region of the world that is mostly does not share a lot of the demographics of Australia itself, and like asserting this lineage and this tie with where a lot of people come from. But so you can see that being kind of core to the identity there. But then it's a bit more complicated than that, as Isaac talks about this in the piece, is Australia, for its part in the contest itself, wants to assert itself as not an exclusively white country. And the participants there tend to be very diverse and represent, you know, either indigenous or some immigrant communities or non-white immigrant communities within Australia. So there's this very complex relationship with clearly whiteness as a part of that, but then sort of working with it and against it and showing that you're both of it and more than just a white European.
Yeah. And yet at the same time, that's a really, really Eurovision thing to do. I would say two of the main and again and again recurring options in how to style your Eurovision performance involve sort of participating in a queer LGBTQ community and culture. And the other is participating or drawing on folktale and folklore cultures. And both are interesting and complex in their own right. When it comes to sort of like folklore and folktale performance styles, that can get really kind of complex and problematic as well, because the provenance can get a little bit messy, and sometimes it can be just like reductive.
Anytime someone clings a bit too much to these sort of mythologized, you know, kind of invented tradition type things of a European country, you got, I don't want to say it's always a bit right wing, but you start getting a little nervous sometimes.
Yeah, even in the ones where that isn't the sort of like main thing, it can still be a little bit reductive and it can kind of like oversimplify. But it's an effort to kind of show the historic character of a certain country. So Europe doesn't really have an indigenous population. The exception to this is the Sami people who live in Scandinavia. And so I think in 1980, Norway very famously had a Sami, performed a song that had a title in the Sami language and that also involved Sami folk singing. This is just one example, but there are many, many others of where kind of like folk music is really integrated into the Eurovision scene. And that has slowly over time, I would say, morphed with a kind of idea that Eurovision is a place that celebrates diversity. And so I think it's like, it's kind of complicated because it's two things at the same time. On the one hand, it's exactly what you say. There's this kind of like edge of an overemphasis on a kind of sort of romanticized version of what it means to be like historically European. But at the on the other hand, there's also a kind of an attempt to celebrate diverse cultures and also indigenous cultures in a continent that doesn't really have much indigeneity, which I think, yeah. And so I think Australia, on the one hand, is trying to establish itself as a modern and diverse and inclusive nation. And on the other hand, fits squarely into the Eurovision performance world.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. This like very conservative cultural essentialism on one hand, and then also, you know, but you're combining all of those things both on the European level, but then maybe even on the nation level, you're saying actually we're more than the essentialist. And I'm just seeing some of the songs, I'm like, is this kind of fashy or is this actually really progressive? And you can't quite wrap your head around it completely.
Yeah, I do think also that this kind of desire to visibly celebrate diversity has grown in the last 10 years. Some of that can feel performative, but it's definitely a trend.
And then moving on, very relatedly, but sort of more specific on the this year-to-year relationship between politics and some of the winners or the performances, because as you mentioned, you know, Eurovision always says, oh, we're so, you know, we're not political. Basically, anytime an institution says that a lot, you're like, yeah, okay, you know, like think of the U.S. Supreme Court or something. It's like the more you have to say that, the more it clearly is probably not the case. And there's a few notable years where either the host or the winner is pretty relevant to what's going on in actual kind of hard, high-level European politics. You know, there was obviously Ukraine both winning, and then that was the last year, right? And then also hosting it after the Orange Revolution. So could you talk, you know, maybe specifically about Ukraine's role in Eurovision and how that has dovetailed at these various points with political turmoil in the country, and then maybe some other kind of notable examples of, you know, like the winners or the hosts having a lot of political significance.
So Ukraine won for the first time in 2004 with Ruslana, who sang Wild Dances. It was the third country from the former Eastern Bloc to win Eurovision. Estonia had won in 2001 and Latvia in 2002. So you can see that, like, in the early 2000s, there's a definite trend of these kind of former Eastern Bloc countries now taking the Eurovision crown. Yeah, so then they hosted it the next year in 2005. And I know that there was some uncertainty if they would be able to because of the Orange Revolution. And then last year was really interesting because the kind of outcome of Eurovision was a foregone conclusion. Everybody knew that in 2022, the Ukraine would win Eurovision. There was more or less no question about it. The winning act was Kalush Orchestra, and their song was Stefania. They did pretty well with the kind of, like, so judges and the European people can vote. Judges give points, and then people can sort of like call or text in, and that then is the so-called popular vote. So Ukraine did okay with the judges, but then the popular vote was like out of this world. Everyone voted for Ukraine pretty much. That's not a very statistical analysis, but it's pretty much true.
Yeah.
And it's It's interesting because there was this kind of like sense that voting for Ukraine in Eurovision meant something. But of course, that's not true because Eurovision is a mass entertainment stage that is quote unquote apolitical. And yet it also is true because it was kind of such a sort of emotionally loaded and symbolic moment for these musicians who had come from their war-torn country to perform on this stage. And then this year, because it cannot be hosted in Ukraine, Liverpool is hosting Eurovision. And last year, England was the second.
Oh, so this is, we probably should have said this earlier, and I'm just realizing the logic of it now, is if you win, you get to host it the next year. Is that the pattern here?
Yeah,
that
if
I'm
you
drawing?
Win, you okay. host it the next year.
Like I, yeah,
yeah,
like
yeah.
I said.
So if you win, you host it the next year. Ukraine won last year, but they can't host it because there's still a war going on. So the sort of second place went to Great Britain last year, and Liverpool is hosting on the behalf of the winning nation, Ukraine. It's also sort of like added on to this is Russia has been, the EBU has banned Russia. They're not allowed to participate in Eurovision anymore, but they weren't able to do that because for political reasons, because Eurovision is apolitical. So you can't say, well, we disagree with you invading another country for political reasons. Instead, they had to frame it in a sort of like non-political way, which is kind of, yeah,
well, it's interesting
as well.
It's quintessentially European. And in both of these things you recently say is that they can, you know, same with, you know, looking at the European Union as an analog, where it's this, the decisions are made under the guise of technocracy, but it's of course very political, and you can always sort of like hide your hands and say, oh, what? I'm not doing anything. This is just the technical nature of the European Broadcasting Union. But obviously, you're not going to want to have Russia in the contest due to the political reason of the invasion. You can always kind of hide the ball a little bit with the decision to do that. And then also in the actual decision of who wins, I had forgotten about the both the kind of the judges and the popular front. It's very also European in a way of being having this kind of technocracy at the core, and it's sort of like a managed democracy that people can vote, but then there's this sort of the experts that also have a voice, and this kind of fear that, oh, maybe this popular mob will outweigh these experts who know best. And then on some levels you can assert popular democracy in certain things, but it's meant to not be the whole of it. You know, we don't want to have the masses having too much power over this. And so both of those things seem to parallel the broader political situation in, you know, Europe as a whole, and defined in political terms.
Yeah, especially with the sort of picking up on the voting thing. The voting regulations for how the Eurovision contest winner is decided have changed at several points over the years. And there's been lots of different systems, and some of them worked better than others. And now they have one which is kind of split between judges and the popular vote, in a slightly different way than it used to be. But the fact that there have been so many changes over the years, and that it has been such a contentious topic, how do we vote? How do we let people vote? Is kind of quite interesting. Again, this is also a technological thing that you can even sort of like, it used to be by phone, and now you can vote by text or on the app and this kind of thing. And so you have the kind of the politics of like, who gets to choose the Eurovision winner? Is it sort of like music judges, or is it sort of the European people, in quotes? And then you have the technological aspect of, well, how do people get to vote and participate in this? And then a sort of like similar thing in terms of controlling the Eurovision Song Contest and having it play out as kind of like free and unpredictable and unpolitical within very, very strictly regulated limitations is also language restrictions. And this too is a kind of political question. So for a long time, you had to sing in the language, in a language that is an official language of your country. And this kind of flipped back and forth in the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s. And in 1998, the language restriction was lifted, and now you can sing in any language that you want. And most people choose to sing in English, although there are also every year entries in sort of national languages as well. And that's another case that kind of like fits exactly what you were saying, where, yeah, you know, at the end of the day, the choices that you're allowed to make on the stage are being sort of very much scrutinized and limited in a really sort of like conscious way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And the Ukrainian song from last year was in Ukrainian, if I remember
it
correctly.
It was, yes. Okay. Yes.
And we should be fair to them, you know, even though they won by the sort of outpouring of public support, which obviously tied into having been invaded, the song was pretty good. It's not like it was a total pity vote. Like it was pretty catchy.
So no.
Just want to give the Ukrainians their credit there.
Absolutely. I wouldn't say it was a pity vote at all. The 2004 song that won was partly in English and partly Ukrainian. And it was the first non-English song to win after the language ban was lifted.
Yeah, okay.
So sort of like 6 years in.
Yeah. Okay. Really interesting. You alluded to this point, but I think we can kind of just get back to it real quickly, is that there's kind of these countries that really, it seemed like maybe they take it a little bit more seriously, that have this kind of tenuous relationship with Europeanness, and they like give it their all. Whereas I think you cite the UK in a couple instances, like they have their own, you know, world beating pop culture industry. And there's, you know, obviously dozens and dozens of famous UK bands that don't need the venue of Eurovision to get onto the world stage, which obviously has to do with you know, the language and then the history, you know, imperial legacy, everything like that. So, you know, Britain then has this sort of more like ironic distance in some cases that you identify. Whereas, you know, I don't know, Romania, Ukraine or whatever, it's sort of more like pouring their whole heart and soul into this competition. Could you talk a little bit about that and then this relationship between core and periphery? You mentioned it a bit earlier, but I think there's a couple of good examples there that drive the point home.
I think it's a great example of a Great Britain sort of, or United Kingdom, participate in a very kind of like tongue-in-cheek way, and are famous for their sort of like sardonic televised commentary. So Graham Norton is the one who comments it every year, and he was preceded by Terry something, who was even more famous, and I'm sorry that I have forgotten his name. He was before my time.
You're forgiven on this podcast.
And he was also sort of very famous for how witty and how sort of like ironic he was. And Graham Norton has kind of like continued that tradition of commentary, where Eurovision, watching Eurovision with a group of friends in England or in the UK, essentially is kind of like, well, this is like ridiculous fun and it's not to be taken seriously. Whereas I think in sort of some other countries in Europe, Eurovision is a chance to be put on the map and to have, you know, hundreds of millions of people watch you and be like, huh, like, this is pretty cool. I want to learn more about, like, Malta or something like this. And so I think that is kind of like a place, if you're kind of like more on the periphery, then this is a bigger chance for you because you need the platform more than a country like the United Kingdom or Germany might. And so while kind of these quote-unquote central European countries who don't need the Eurovision stage as much kind of treat it with ridicule, countries that are more sort of like on the periphery, especially in the Balkans, or we might think of the Baltic states, who I'd mentioned earlier, Estonia and Latvia, both winning in the early 2000s, they take it much more seriously. But what I think has been interesting is that when countries like Serbia end up winning Eurovision, I'm just thinking of this example from 2007, then that kind of unleashes a debate within all of Europe and also these kind of central countries on, well, what kind of role should we allow Eastern European countries to have in our Eurovision world? And so even though they, you know, the UK and France and Germany might pretend to dismiss Eurovision, there is debate and there is interest and there is this kind of like sense of, well, it's unfair if Eastern European countries just vote for each other. That's political voting. And it's unfair if we don't ever win because we pay more money to participate. And so there's this kind of like ambivalent tension that is involved there.
It's almost a bit heavy-handed to point out, but like you see such analogous behavior again at the European Union level of like, these people, they're sort of tenuous belonging of like, well, you're new to the club, but it's basically our club that we've let you in. And like, we kind of float your boat. And now like, you know, the Baltics and like Poland say, and the geopolitical sphere are kind of asserting themselves and saying, you know, we're really trying to actually drive like EU policy on some level. And you know, France and Germany can say, oh, like, let's take it easy, like, trigger happy Eastern Europeans, like, come on now. And like, can see this, you know, the being allowed in both on the political level and the song level here. I find the UK example really interesting because having their kind of ironic distance, again, paralleling a bit their relationship with Europe in general. But it's also like by keeping this ironic distance and aloofness, they're both kind of asserting their somewhat, you know, like a bit like ownership of Europe, but also this sort of political distance that they can kind of opt in and opt out at will. But at the same time, by doing that, they're asserting a core British identity and really performing Britishness by being ironic and kind of self-effacing and not being overly cringe and into it. And so it's like by not going all in a way that is going all in, because they're being, you know, it's as much an assertion of national identity as, you know, Ukrainians wearing little flower cranes or like the traditional dress. It's like that is the traditional Britishness. And so it's like, are you in or are you out? You know, are you maximizing your commitment to it or are you minimizing it?
Yeah, and I think the UK has a huge sort of like community of people who love Eurovision. I want to say that Brighton, the sort of the city in the UK, has one of the biggest Eurovision parties in Europe. I think it's quite famous that every year everyone goes to Brighton to party and celebrate Eurovision.
I think that's a good actual transition to the kind of the final main point I have here. Brighton, the city on the English Channel, famous for having an LGBTQ community there. So that would make a lot of sense. And that ties into
exactly
this point that I want to make about the role of queer and trans representation throughout the history of the contest. I mean, there's obviously probably volumes that could be written on this, but if we could just maybe talk about kind of the general spirit there as well as some of these kind of like key moments where that really seemed like it became a core element of the ESC.
In the 1960s, this is often sort of like cited as when Eurovision sort of for the first time became a kind of site for queer representation. There was a song that was performed and that won, I think, that spoke about love and without gendered pronouns, and it was widely assumed that it was about a man loving a man.
Yeah, again, I can actually quote from Isaac's piece here. He had a little paragraph on it, and so quoting here now. Eurovision's queer history can be traced to the first years of the song contest. In 1961, Luxembourg's representative Jean-Claude Pascal won with the song Nous les amoureux, don't speak French, sorry, we are the lovers. The lyrics were ambiguous and refrained from using gendered pronouns, but told of a thwarted love affair. They would like to separate us, they would like to hinder us from being happy, he sang. Pascal, who was himself gay, although not out at the time, later explained that the song was about challenges faced by LGBTQ plus community during an era when queer and trans was still illegal in many countries participating in Eurovision. So there you go. Very interesting moment. I mean, and yeah, 1961, both, as he says, at the close to the start of the contest, and then thinking about the broader political climate at the time, you can see how that would be a pretty bold and kind of revolutionary thing to assert at the time. And now it's kind of a core element.
Yeah. And sort of that is often identified as the sort of root of where Eurovision and sort of LGBTQ plus culture, since then they have been kind of so closely aligned. In the 90s, I think Israel won with Dana International, or who was the first trans or openly trans performer at Eurovision. And then, as I've already mentioned, Conchita Wurst is sort of like a real Eurovision icon of more recent years. Going back to this kind of center-periphery conversation, that's also really interesting when it comes to sort of LGBTQ plus issues, because oftentimes the sort of legal structures and national culture in some of these countries is not always LGBTQ plus friendly. And yet, in order to kind of participate in the Eurovision world, this culture is so celebrated, it has to be part of that. So an example is Azerbaijan won, and there were a lot of protests when Azerbaijan was allowed to host Eurovision in Baku because of the kind of systemic homophobia in Azerbaijan. There's also sort of, I think it was Slovenia, in deciding on sort of like their act, there were like a lot of internal debates in the country. We should definitely check this. But there was kind of like internal debates where they were like, well, we want to win Eurovision, so we should send a queer act. And then part of the country was like, well, we can't, because that's not what it means. That's not what it is to be Slovenian. And I think the kind of the vote or the decision was like 51% to 49% or something like this. So I think negotiating how can we participate as Europeans in Eurovision for countries who feel like they're on the periphery and who maybe in some cases, not in all cases, but in some cases have a sort of more openly homophobic culture, that can be a really sticky point of contention, because that's obviously not what Eurovision represents.
No, I guess this seems very stereotypical for me to now do to make as an analogy, but thinking of like American college football in during the civil rights era, and how some of the best teams are in the South. And as you know, some teams integrated and could have African-American players who, you know, really dominate the sport today. Obviously there'd be some of these racist coaches and teams in the southern states, and they didn't want to have black players, but then it becomes more and more clear that to actually be competitive going forward, you need to have this. And it seems like a somewhat analogous situation of like, do we want to have a really talented queer performer, but then that undermines our identity, but we also want to win. And it's like this like negotiating progress and, you know, having national pride. And it's like, do you have more pride in your representative as a team or an artist representing your kind of conservative cultural values, or do you have more pride in them being a bit more diverse but actually maybe winning the thing? And how conservative elements negotiate those contradictions is interesting.
Yeah, and how are you going to be European on a Eurovision stage if you're not ready to embrace queer performance which is sort of so integral to the Eurovision culture.
That's really. I don't know if I'm gonna watch it. I'm in the U.S. currently, so I don't know if the time change will facilitate it. But like, I'm definitely, after an hour of chatting about this, I definitely am definitely more interested than I was before. I mean, I think that's about all I wanted to cover. We're coming up to the time we try to keep here. So any more kind of substantive points before we close out maybe with a bit of speculation and chat about this year's contest specifically?
I don't know. For anyone who is interested in Eurovision but doesn't really like know what is going on, and sort of like wants to approach the world of Eurovision slowly, there was a movie that came out recently. It's an American movie, starring Will Ferrell and Rachel McAdams. And Dan Stevens, I think, is my personal opinion, is kind of like the star of the show. And it does a pretty good job. It's a really fun sort of like comedy about these two Icelandic singers who go to Eurovision, and they're kind of chaotic. But it has a lot of sort of like Eurovision, like within the Eurovision universe, there's some people who are famous for Eurovision only, and it has a lot of these people come as guest star and as cameos. And it kind of embraces what makes Eurovision so wonderfully ridiculous. I think Eurovision is, you know, Eurovision is political and it is fraught and there is tension, but it is also very, very fun. And I think sometimes it's okay to just watch Eurovision for the fun of it.
Yeah, don't be too serious about it. But obviously, we're going to have to talk about some of that stuff on this podcast. I like how you framed it. You know, give people their baby steps in case there's people like me of the similar opinion of Eurovision. You know, let them warm up to it slowly. So yeah, Kat, this is phenomenal and really interesting. Thanks so much. But to close out, who you got for Saturday night in the final?
It's a good question. Scandinavian countries have always been strong. I think they're the ones who dominated the 20 teams. We'll see if Sweden will successfully make its comeback.
Okay, well, stay tuned for that. We may already have the verdict by the time you hear this, but I think this analysis is timeless for any future Eurovision Song Contest as well. Kat, that was phenomenal. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your insights, both with a relatively ignorant person like me and with our listeners.
No, thank you very much for having me.
That's great. And thanks everybody for listening. We will catch you next time on the Spaßbremse premium feed. And as always, if anyone could share the podcast, rate, review, everything like that to spread the word. You know, we're expanding our potential demographic with things like this rather than talking about, you know, the Eurozone or whatever, trying to branch out. So this is great. Thanks again, Kat. And again, thanks to all the listeners. Tschüss.